An attractive, well-dressed woman flags down a taxi in London, jumps in the back, and settles in for her ride. The cabbie, being a friendly sort, starts a casual conversation and eventually gets around to asking, "So what do you do?" She answers, "I'm a scholar of religion." To which the taxi driver responds emphatically that religion is the cause of all the major wars in history. It's the source of practically all the trouble in the world today. As the scholar listens silently to this barrage, which she has heard many times before in taxis, around dinner tables, and at charity events and cocktail parties, she wonders, "Why didn't I just say I was a typist?" As she listens to the cabbie's points, she, of course, sees the merit in his position. In fact, the hatred and greed and fear which cause warfare and violence all too often have been given religious justification. And she thinks, still, each of the major faiths I've discovered in my studies has at its core the ethic of compassion. Every single one of them has developed some version of the golden rule: never to treat others as you would not like to be treated yourself. And they've each said that this is the test of spirituality, that it's this which takes us beyond the prism of ego and selfishness and greed, that enables us to enter our best selves, to enter into the presence of what some have called God, others Nirvana, Brahman, or Tao. And yet she thinks with frustration, you don't hear about that very often. I mean, when religious leaders get together to talk, they often come to talk about a particular sexual ethic or some doctrine, as though these, rather than compassion, might be the tests of a spiritual life. And so at some point after one too many of these taxi rides, she decides to do something about this. And she can, because she's not a typist, but she's the world-renowned author of 12 books on comparative religion, some of which have been translated into 45 languages. She's Karen Armstrong. And she's, of course, received all kinds of awards for her work. One of the ones you might know, one of her first and most famous is A History of God. But she's become more and more famous and has expanded beyond just the monotheistic religions into Eastern religions. And in 2008, she received the TED Prize from the TED Conference, which came out of bringing together people from technology, entertainment, and design, and has now become a very popular app on many iPhones, or a place to go on your internet browser and see these amazing talks. But they have something called the TED Prize, and they give this to people who they think could change the world. Whoa. So given this TED Prize and this task of somehow changing the world, Karen Armstrong decided to create a charter for compassion. And we heard just a little bit about that, a little bit from that in our opening words. And so she actually invited people from really all over the world to come together to put together this document. So as I said, when I attributed it to her in the order of service, that was inaccurate, because it was written by people representing Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism. So that it's a demonstration at this point in our history, when it seems like there is so much assumption that religions are at loggerheads, that in fact there is so much that we have in common, and that we could work together to create a better world. And Karen Armstrong says this is the religious task of our time. And it has really taken off. She's been especially astounded about Pakistan and how engaged they are in this. When she was there launching it, 3 lectures a day and 1,000 people attended. So this country, Pakistan, we can imagine, knows in a way that we can't the cost of allowing compassion to be set aside and letting dogmatism and hatred come to the forefront. One of the ways that it is coming to the forefront in Pakistan, compassion is that the company who makes Sesame Street there, Sesame Street, which is called Simsim Hamara in Pakistan, is actually introducing a new character, so a new Muppet, who is meant to embody how to be compassionate, to teach the children who watch Simsim Hamara how to be compassionate. And when Karen Armstrong was there, she met with the company who's creating this character and doing Sesame Street, and she said, now, I don't want this guy to be some, like, wimp, some sweet little wimpy compassionate character. I want him to be really cool, and I want him to be clever and smart and funny, and I don't want him to do it right all the time. I want it to be clear that compassion isn't easy. In many Buddhist traditions and in the Shambhala tradition, there's this idea of a warrior of compassion. So when we think about a warrior, we think about someone who is brave and courageous and maybe even ambitious and uses weapons in order to achieve and prove this courage. But this idea of a warrior is very different. Certainly, it requires a lot of courage, but it also requires gentleness. It's like if we think of Mahatma Gandhi and the idea of nonviolence and how much more effort and courage it took to participate in nonviolence and that form of compassion than actually to participate in violence. So we can think of this need for courage, that this is not easy. It is a challenge for us all. Karen Armstrong says the charter is not just this feel-good document where we all embrace one another and then feel compassionate at the end of the day. It's a call to action. It's a challenge for us all, and it is the challenge for our time. So compassion, I think, is a word that we often can get confused about, that we tend to collapse it with a sense of pity, if you will. And in fact, when Armstrong was giving a lecture in Holland, she was in the lecture saying, compassion doesn't mean feeling sorry for people. But in the Dutch translation of her talk in the newspaper, the word compassion was translated into the equivalent of pity in Dutch. So that was very frustrating for her. And I would say that pity is actually an enemy of compassion. So it's not like it's, you know, a close cousin. It's the opposite. Because if we think about it, when we're in pity, we're actually separating ourselves from that other person. There's this sense of otherness. And I think there's this sense of aboveness. I'm kind of standing above someone and looking down on them with pity. I'm not standing next to them, able to be touched by them, able to be open to them and their experience. And I think we need to be aware of this in our social justice work, and I might call, you know, charity work. An Aboriginal woman in Australia says, if you have come to help me, then you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your destiny is bound up with mine, then let us work together. Another block to compassion can be self-pity. We can kind of be like, oh, my life is so difficult. Everything's so hard. I'm so overwhelmed. We sort of feel like, I don't have room for compassion for other people. Are you kidding? I'm going to lose myself. If I really get serious about compassion, I'll have to give away all my money and all my belongings to the poor, or I'm going to have to listen all day, every day to this long tales of sorrow from the despairing people that we all might know in our lives who would talk and talk and talk as long as we would listen. Or we're going to have to dedicate all our time and energy to solving all the problems in the town that we live in or our extended family. So we push this away. We fear we're going to become overwhelmed by the sufferings of others. But it loses sight of the fact that compassion extends to everyone, and that actually includes ourselves. So it doesn't mean if we reorient our attention away from selfishness that we no longer attend to ourselves. But what we want to recognize is interdependence. Because I really don't want to get my needs met at the expense of others. I want to live in a world where everyone's needs matter. And if I can bring compassion to myself and my own sense of overwhelm and my own sense of resistance to compassion even, then that's also a way for me to cultivate compassion towards others. We saw that in the meditation practice. We want to include ourselves. And I think that that's why Karen Armstrong has actually chosen as the symbol for the Charter of Compassion, this kind of infinity sign drawn with a calligraphy brush. And for me, it brings to mind a Möbius strip. You guys know what a Möbius strip is? Where there's really this interweaving. What appears separate isn't. So it looks like I have two different sides of this strip, but if I actually run my finger along it, there's like, it never off. So it looks like there's two sides, but really, if I run my finger along the side, there's only one side. What appears separate is not separate. There's a wonderful Christian theologian who is not so well known, Howard Thurman. He's a 20th century theologian who is a really wonderful inspiration to Martin Luther King. And he wrote, God is at work, enlarging the boundaries of my heart. God is making room in my heart for compassion. There is already a vast abundance of room for pity. It is often easy to be overcome with self-pity, that sticky substance that ruins everything it touches. My list of excuses is a long list, and even as I say it, I know that under closest scrutiny, they disappear one by one. There is pity in me, pity for others. But there is something in it that cannot be trusted. It's mixed with pride, arrogance, cunning. I see what my pity really is and the sources from which it springs. God is making room in my heart for compassion. The awareness that where my life begins is where your life begins. The awareness that a sensitivity to your needs cannot be separated from a sensitivity to my needs. The awareness that the joys of my heart are never mine alone, nor are my sorrows. I struggle against the work of God in my heart. I want to be left alone. I want my boundaries to remain fixed that I may be at rest. But even now, as I turn to God in the quietness, God's work in me is ever the same. God is at work, enlarging the boundaries of my heart. And we never know when these moments might come, when suddenly our heart boundaries will be opened. Brita Gil Ostern was one of my professors in seminary, and she's also an ordained minister, like many professors in seminary. And she was serving a church in Philadelphia, and she was taking the metro to get to church on a Sunday morning, and you might picture her there working on her sermon, trying to get it down to size. I can't imagine anyone having to do that. So she was very intent on her work and a little anxious about the service ahead. And then at one station, an older man who had, you know, a lot of, beard growth, kind of dirty, kind of smelly, gets on and stands in front of people and says hello to them, and they look away, confused. He's even greeting some people by name. And finally he says to Brita, I recognize everyone, and no one recognizes me. So then Brita, being a minister, realizes that she can set aside her sermon and attend to this person in front of her. And so she asks him to sit down, and she asks him his name. And he keeps saying, you know what? You and me are twins. We have two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. That makes you and me twins. And then he got off at the next stop. And she had this sense in a way that she really hadn't known before, that the only people who see with holy eyes are the ones who see their unity with all. Compassion comes from a Greek and Latin root that really means about enduring something with another person. In Arabic and Hebrew, it's related to a word that is connected etymologically to the word for womb. So we have this kind of idea of not only sort of, you know, walking in someone else's shoes, but this kind of love of a mother for a child. And if we think about that, you know, that icon, that love for a mother at a child, you know, it's really us at our best. But mother love is hard. I have a, you know, real life experience of this now. You know, getting up at night, no matter how tired you are, attending to this child's needs, no matter how cranky or exhausted you might be feeling, it is not easy. And then, of course, that baby grows up and becomes who knows what kind of awful disappointment to you. But still, that mother doesn't give up. So this is what we mean by compassion. And, you know, let's acknowledge that not all mothers are able to live up to this iconic idea of motherhood, that some of them can't act on those compassionate instincts that are within them because of circumstances, addictions, mental or physical health issues, or their own deficient parenting. And a particularly tender story of this kind of mothering comes from a reader of the Sun magazine in Marietta, Georgia, who wrote some descriptions of her mother, assuring that unspeakable punishment was bound to befall any child as naughty as I was. And even at one point when she asked her mother, "Do you love me?" her mother's answer was, "How could anyone ever love you?" Of course, in this moment, she was had just been returned home by the police for trying to run away. But you can just feel the devastation of this. And she says that as a child, in this difficult childhood, from the age of 5 or 6 until I was well into my teens, whenever I had trouble sleeping, I would slip out from under my covers and steal into the kitchen for a bit of bread or cheese, which I would carry back to bed with me. There, I'd pretend my hands belonged to someone else, a comforting, reassuring being without a name, an angel perhaps. The right hand would feed me little bites of cheese or bread as the left hand stroked my cheeks and hair. My eyes closed, I would whisper softly to myself, "There, there, go to sleep. You're safe now. Everything will be all right. I love you." So we can see that this impulse for compassion is within us, was within this girl who was living in such harsh circumstances. And the longing for compassion and the capacity to provide it, those two things are interwoven. When we hear a story like this, or if we have a memory or experience of this kind of loneliness, we can remember there are many others in the world who experience the same loneliness. Their circumstances are their own, but their pain and suffering feels the same. Tara Brock is an American Buddhist practitioner and psychotherapist, and she writes about relief that came to her as she was in the midst of deep suffering, weeks and weeks of grieving a relationship that had ended. Her misery was intense and seemed unending. And then she remembered on the Buddhist path of the Bodhisattva, suffering is a gateway to opening the heart. She realized maybe if she stopped fighting her grief and loneliness in her heart. She remembered the aspiration of the Bodhisattva, may this suffering serve to awaken compassion. And she began to repeat that to herself over and over and let herself feel the intense longing that her loneliness pointed to. And then she started to experience compassion. She writes, "I was vibrating with a love that embraced the whole of this living world. It embraced my moving breath, the singing of birds, the wetness of tears, and the endless sky. Dissolving into that warm and shining immensity, I no longer felt any distinction between my heart and the heart of compassion. All that was left was an enormous tenderness tinged with sadness. She discovered the truth of the 14th century Persian poet Hafiz, whose poem reads, "Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you as few human or even divine ingredients. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need of God absolutely clear." So for Tara, this mindful prayer, may this suffering serve to awaken compassion, helped her transform her personal suffering into expansive compassion. And she actually grew up as a Unitarian. They used to joke that prayers were addressed to whom it may concern. But without worrying to whom our prayer may be directed, we can recognize the power of a prayer or an aspiration to affect us, to awaken our compassionate heart. We sang a prayer together, asking that we all experience loving kindness. When we encounter a difficult situation, we could say to ourselves, "I care about this suffering," whether it's your own suffering or someone else's. We can send the hope, "May we be free from suffering. May we experience peace." You could find a phrase that resonates for you that feels authentic to awaken compassion within you, because in any moment, there is compassion available to us. It is part of our natural makeup. It is part of our inherent worth and dignity. There is always more love somewhere. And we can keep on until we find it.